provisions of the agreement requiring an accounting for all missing in action in Indochina, the provisions with regard to Laos and Cambodia, and the provisions prohibiting infiltration from North Vietnam into South Vietnam have been violated, if not been compliant. We have and will continue to comply with the agreement. We shall insist that North Vietnam comply with the agreement. The leaders of North Vietnam should have no doubt as to the consequences if they fail. Despite these difficulties, we can be proud of the fact that we have achieved our goal, of achieving our goal, of obtaining an agreement which brings peace with us in Vietnam. On this day, let us honor those who made this achievement possible, those who sacrificed their lives, those who were disabled, those who made every one of us proud of being an American as they returned from years of communism. Every one of the 2.5 million Americans who served honorably in our nation's armed forces. Never have men served. Served with greater devotion abroad, with less apparent support at home. Let us provide these men with the veterans' benefits and the jobs or opportunities they have earned, and let us honor them with the respect they deserve. And I say again tonight, let us not dishonor those who serve their country by granting amnesty to those who deserve it. Tonight, I want to express the appreciation of the nation and others who helped make this day possible. I refer you. The great majority of Americans listening to me tonight, despite an unprecedented barrage of criticism from a small but vocal minority, stood firm for peace with us. I know it was not easy for you to do so. We have been through some difficult times together. I recall the time in November 1969 when hundreds of thousands of protesters marched from the White House. The time in April 1970 when I found the necessary order tax on communist bases. Time in May 1972, when I ordered the mining of Haiphong and airstrikes on military targets in North Vietnam in order to stop the massive communist invasion of South Vietnam. And then, perhaps the hardest decision I have made as president, on December 18, 1972, when our hopes for peace were so high, and when the North Vietnamese stonewalled us to the communist kingdom, I found it necessary to order more airstrikes on military targets in North Vietnam. On each of these occasions, the voices of opposition we heard in Washington were so loud that at times they seemed to be the majority. But across America, the overwhelming majority stood firm against those who advocated peace at any price, even if the price would have been defeat and humiliation for the United States. Because you stood firm for doing what was right, Colonel McKnight was able to say for his fellow POWs when he returned home, "Thank you for bringing us home on our feet instead of on our knees." Let us turn now to some of our problems at home. Tonight, I ask your support and look back. We can be thankful that this is not a battle of war abroad, but a battle we must win if we are to build a new prosperity without war and without inflation at home. What I refer to is the battle of the budget. Not just the battle of the federal budget, but even more important, the battle of your budget. Family budget of every home in America. One of the most terrible costs of war, inflation. The cost of living has skyrocketed during every war we've been engaged in. We recognize this nation 4 years ago. We've taken strong action to deal with it. The result of our policies, we have cut the rate of inflation in half since it reached its peak in 1960. Today, our rate of inflation is the lowest of any major industrial nation in the world. But these positive statistics are small comfort to a family trying to make both ends meet. And they're no comfort at all to the housewife who sees meat prices soaring every time she goes to the market. The major weak spot in our rate of inflation is in the area of meat prices. I have taken action to heading to Congress for the next year, the largest budget in our history, $268 billion. The amount I've requested in this budget for domestic programs in such fields as health, housing, education, and aid to the elderly, the handicapped, the poor, is twice as big as the amount in my first budget for 4 years ago. However, some members of Congress believe the budget in these areas should be even higher. If I were to approve the increases in my budget that have been proposed in the Congress, it would mean a 15% increase in your taxes or an increase in your prices for every American. And that is why I shall veto the bills which would break the federal budget which I have submitted. If I do not veto these bills, increased prices or taxes would break the family budget of billions of Americans. This is not a battle between Congress and the President. It is your battle. It is your money and your prices and your taxes I am trying to save. 25 years ago as a freshman in Congress, when I met President Truman in this office, I remember he had a sign on the desk. It read, "The buck stops here." That meant, of course, that the President can't pass the buck to anyone else when a tough decision has to be made. It also means that your buck stops here. If I do not act to stop the spending increases which Congress sends to my desk, you will have to pay the bill. I admit there's an honest difference of opinion on the matter of the federal budget. If you're willing to pay the higher taxes or prices that will result if we increase federal spending over my budget to some Congress proposed, you should ask your congressman and your senators to override my details. But if you want to stop the rise in taxes and prices, then I have a suggestion. I remember when I was a congressman and senator, I always seemed to hear from those who wanted government to spend more, and I seldom heard from the people who have to pay the bill, the taxpayer. If your congressman or senator has the courage to vote against more spending so that you won't have to pay higher prices or taxes, let him know you support him. Winning the battle to hold down the federal budget is essential if we are to achieve our goal of a new prosperity without war and without inflation. I ask tonight for your support in helping to achieve this in helping to win this vital important battle. Turn finally tonight to another great challenge. As we end America's longest war, let us resolve that we shall not lose the peace. During the past year, we have made great progress toward our goal of a generation of peace for America and the world. The war in Vietnam has been ended. After 20 years of hostility and confrontation, we have opened a constructive new relationship with the People's Republic of China, where 1/4 of all the people in the world live. We negotiated last year with the Soviet Union a number of important agreements, including an agreement which takes a major step in limiting nuclear arms. There are some who say that in view of all this progress toward peace, why not cut our defense budget? Well, let's look at the facts. Our defense budget today takes the lowest percentage of our gross national product in 20 years. And there's nothing I would like better than to be able to reduce it further. But we must never forget that we would not have made the progress toward lasting peace that we have made in this past year unless we had had the military strength that commanded respect. This year, we have begun a new negotiation with the Soviet Union for further limitations of nuclear arms. We should be participating later in the year in negotiations for mutual reduction of forces in Europe. If prior to these negotiations, we unilaterally reduce our defense money or reduce our forces in Europe, any chance for successful negotiations for mutual reduction of forces or limitation of arms will be destroyed. There is one unbreakable rule of international diplomacy. You can't get something in a negotiation unless you have something to give. If we cut our defenses before negotiations begin, any incentive other nations would have to cut theirs would be completely ruined. If the United States reduces its defenses and others do not, it increases the danger of war. It is only a mutual reduction of forces that will reduce the danger of war. We must maintain our strength until we get agreements under which other nations will join us in reducing the burden of our defense. was at stake, whether the United States shall become the second strongest nation in the world. If that day should ever come, the chances for building a new structure of peace in the world would be irreparably damaged, and free nations everywhere would be living in moral danger. A strong United States is not a threat to peace. It is the free world's indispensable guardian of peace and freedom. I ask for your support tonight for keeping the strength which enabled us to make such great progress toward world peace in this past year, and which is indispensable as we continue our bold new initiatives to make for peace in the years ahead. Consider some of our problems tonight. Let us never forget how fortunate we are to be living in America at this time. We have ended the longest and most difficult war in our history in a way that maintained the trust of our allies and the respect. We are the strongest and most prosperous nation in the world today. Because of our strength, America has a magnificent opportunity to play the leading role in bringing down the walls of hostility which divide the people of the world, in reducing the burden of armaments in the world, of building the structure of lasting peace in the world. And because of our wealth, we have the means to move forward at home on exciting new programs for progress, which will provide better environment, education, housing, and health care for all Americans, and which will enable us to be more generous to the poor, the elderly, the disabled, and the disadvantaged than any nation in history. These are goals worthy of a great people. Let us, therefore, put aside those honest differences about the war which have divided us, and dedicate ourselves to meet the great challenges of peace which can unite us. But as we do, let us not overlook the third element, more important even than military might or economic power, which is essential for greatness in a nation. The pages of history are strewn with the refuge of nations which fell by the wayside at the height of their strength of love because their people became soft and self-indulgent and lost the character and spirit which had led to their goals. As I speak to you tonight, I am confident this will not happen. My confidence has been increased by the fact that a war which cost America so much in lives, money, and division in home has, as it ended, provided an opportunity for millions of Americans to see again the character and spirit which made America the great nation it is. 2 days ago in this room, I talked to a man who had spent almost 8 years in a communist prison cell in North Vietnam. For over 4 years, he was in solitary. He never spoke to another person in those 4 years except his cat. He gave them 2 meals a day, a piece of bread, and some vegetables. All he was given to read was communist propaganda. All he could hear on the radio was communist propaganda. I asked him how he was able to survive and still come home standing tall and proud, saluting the American flag. He paused a long time. He said, "It isn't easy for me to answer. I'm not very good at words. What I can say is that it was faith. Faith in God. Faith in my God. Who suffered so much for America that has such faith. Let us who have received so much from America renew our faith. Our faith in God. Our faith in America. And our faith in ourselves. We meet the great challenges of peace that lie ahead with this kind of faith. It will one day be ready."